Hello, I am Cody.
And I'm Brent.
And we are the Hugonauts, here to review and discuss for you the best sci-fi novels, we think, of all time. This week, we're talking about Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler and a little bit of the sequel, Parable of the Talents. But make sure you like, subscribe, download, follow, however you listen to us, to not miss our first episode of 2023, which will be on Double Star by Robert Heinlein. But yeah, we were taking a break for the holidays, but we couldn't stay away forever. So let's just call this episode, a holiday special, maybe.
Yeah, we missed you guys. I'm wearing my Santa hat. If you're listening to the podcast, I'm wearing my Santa hat.
Right. Yes. And if you're watching the podcast, you know that Brent is a liar.
No, I'm a trustworthy man. Okay. So here's the deal with Parable of the Sower. So, Parable of the Sower was written in the mid-90s. The sequel, Parable of the Talents, won the Nebula in the year 2000. And that was also notable because Octavia Butler was the first Black woman to win the Nebula Award. So it was a pretty big deal. Parable of the Sower, the first one, is not too long, 352 pages, about 12 hours on audiobook. And it's set in the year 2025, so like 30 years in the future from when it was written. And society is descending into anarchy in the face of climate change, other disasters. And we're following Lauren Alamina, and we actually see the world through her diary entries. The whole book is sort of framed that way. She's a teenager living in a walled-in neighborhood in the exurbs of Los Angeles. And, you know, jobs are scarce, tons of gangs outside. It's a bad time. Her father is the pastor for their little community and also a professor at a local college, like one of the few people who still has a really good job. And he's trying to keep the little community safe, but Lauren really feels that things are going to pieces and is always preparing for things to get worse. So the big question of the book is, when it all does go wrong, will she be ready? You'll have to read it and find out. But that's the setup for Parable of the Sower. What did you think of it, Cody?
I asked Brent when we were doing pre-pro if he got that from the back of the book. And no, he just wrote that question mark blurb himself. So
you gotta have a little mystery.
Yeah, a little spice. I love Parable of the Sower, and I also like Parable of the Talents. I gave Sower a 4 out of 5. I thought it was just a really compelling near future science fiction story about, climate disaster. I think a lot of times we see something that's not quite believable, but here it's kind of disturbing, but realistic representation of what might happen in an extreme climate change world and how it would overly affect the lower socioeconomic classes. And I just thought it was really, and also there's a lot of other added elements. We'll talk about it more, but it's not just about one thing.
Yeah, for sure. I also really liked it. I'll give it a 4 out of 5, but I'm actually not going to say that much about why I give it a 4 out of 5 because it's basically all the same reasons. Just like a very real feeling dystopia. So yeah, I think we should just get into it. I know you're I don't want to call you a big disaster prep guy. That has like a whole bunch of connotations. You're a normal, sane person who likes being prepared. Tell us about how this book made you feel.
I have light fantasies about like what would happen if I don't collect weapons, ammunition, or dry and canned foods, if that's how you would define doomsday prepping. I think, you said it was a prepper's wet dream. I think it kind of is. It shows, you know, you get a lot of those elements that people like in their post-apocalyptic fiction about like, this is what we had and this is how we used it and this is how we got the new stuff. But I thought that was flipped on its head. I guess a counterpoint to that would be that it feels more realistic and it feels like counter to what a prepper thinks is going to happen. It feels like the realistic version. It's like, doesn't really matter how much you stock up. It's going to be dangerous and people are constantly going to try to take it from you. And whoever has the larger group is going to overtake you if you're smaller and you're trying to hold it out by yourself. So it's kind of fruitless. frankly, which I liked about it. I liked pointing out that that type of prepping is fruitless, and what we should really be trying to do is prevent global scale post-apocalyptic type literature worlds from coming to bear.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I felt the same way. I also thought it felt very real because in a lot of dystopian books, like, the disaster happens and then everyone is like, cool, there's no rules anymore. We'll all be like ultra-violent, whatever, people. And in the book, first of all, like, the descent is like slower, but also, like, I don't know, most people live their lives most of the time just like trying to be safe. They want there to be rules. And so there's like scary moments and times. But in general, like, there are police, and they're very corrupt and they won't really do anything. But like, there still are police, and there's the phones work, and like, it's not all like magically in an instant destroyed. And so it feels a little more real.
Yeah. And it's also, I guess I would point out too, we don't really see so much outside of America in this book. And it almost, you know, through some glimpses or descriptions of other countries in the world, in this world, it feels as if perhaps we're just seeing an America that's gone to ruin and not necessarily other countries.
Yeah, that was actually my feeling as well. The more I think on it, it's almost like the natural disasters weren't that bad. It was just like a societal collapse of like trust in the system in the United States, which I actually also think is accurate. There's failed states do really happen, and really, right. You know, Sri Lanka has had just a hell of a year through, and there's a lot of people there who like did nothing wrong and their lives are totally messed up because of a bunch of bad decisions the government made. Anyway, so yeah, I think that also helps with sort of that like sense of realism.
Absolutely. I agree. So let's talk about some of the characters here. We'll just list them off. We've got Lauren Olya Olamina. She's a teenager with hyperempathy syndrome. More on that later. And her siblings, she has several brothers. And then notably, we have Keith, who's her younger brother. He's a troublemaker and is a catalyst for some of the plot points in the book, and to see a little bit outside of their exurb. And then her father, who is a Baptist minister, her father being a Baptist minister lays the foundation for the comparisons between organized religion and Lauren's created religion of Earthseed, which is where you get the title Parable of the Sower, S-O-W-E-R, like sower of seeds.
Yeah, and there's like really short interludes before a lot of the diary entries. You get like a little bit of her like Earthseed writing, like her beliefs.
Yeah, which is part of what makes this book so interesting, is that we have a lot of extra stuff. Not only is the world fascinating and believable from a science fiction post-apocalyptic interest perspective, but we also have this religious concept, this spiritual practice, I guess you'd call it, that she's invented. It's almost more of a practical set of values, right?
Yeah, it gets compared to Buddhism a lot. Like in the books, other characters will compare it to Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a pretty fair comparison in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah. The basic tenet being God is change. So God exists, but God is just the idea that everything changes.
Yeah, God is like entropy.
Right.
The second law of thermodynamics.
Exactly. So it preaches kind of just self-responsibility and adaptability. It doesn't have any, that's it. Those are the tenets. And then also that humans will eventually need to leave Earth and colonize the stars to have enough space and resources.
Well, safety. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just a super interesting idea interposed on the rest of the stuff that's happening.
Meanwhile, they're like descending to like 1900s living standards. And meanwhile, she like can't stop thinking about spaceships.
Right. And it doesn't, like, there's not that much crossover. Like those two pieces of the story don't do anything for each other. They're just both great. And they also add to her character. And I think that's what makes it such a special novel, is that you have, and unique, is that it's focused on two things that are kind of incongruous, that clearly I think just Butler just cared about both of them and wanted to put them in. And I really love when stories have that, because it makes them very special.
I thought it came together more in the sequel, but we'll talk about more about that.
Oh, the Earthseed part of things?
Yeah, Earthseed with like the current timeline and like its impacts on the world. But anyway, we'll talk more. We'll do a post spoilers section at the end after the related book recs, and we'll talk about the sequel a little bit more. But yeah, all right. So we talked about Earthseed. What about the like science? So it is set in like effectively our present day, but they do have some stuff that we don't have. What do you want to talk about the VR, and I'll do the slave collars?
Yeah. The VR is really interesting because it's one of those details. She just kind of touches on it, right? You just get a little bit of it with where Keith has been. It's not really integral to the story, and no one, at least to the first, to Parable of the Sower, there's not too much mention of it. But just the existence of this this hyper, pretty classic science fiction, hyper-realistic VR world that a lot of people, if they can afford it.
The rich people still have nicer stuff. They're like checked out of our bad situation in the VR.
But it's just glanced upon, which it makes the world a little more interesting because it shows the disparities between the wealthy and the poor, and the in the existence of that technology, while everyone else, like you said, is crawling backwards towards the 1900s.
Wearing slave collars, unfortunately.
Right.
The disturbing invention. Maybe the other side of the VR coin, actually, as I think about how these things really might work. But basically, they put a collar on you and then can stimulate your nervous system and make you feel like emotions and pain. And so they enslave people, basically. They put them on them, and then it's like perfect control. You don't have to beat someone or anything like that. You can just immediately make them feel whatever you want, which is a deeply disturbing technology and deployed very effectively. She really explores how much that really does take from you. If you don't even have, you just can't resist at all. It's really tough. So anyway, yes, those are the two big pieces of tech.
Because like you said, it manipulates your emotions as well as your, as well as can cause pain. And the they you're referring to being anybody who purchases slave collars, which I thought was another disturbing and interesting detail of this novel in this world that Butler created, which is to say, there's no such thing as only like good technology that can be used for bad or good, or neutral technology that can be used for bad or good. There's a possibility of making technology that just does bad things.
Yeah, that's right. That is right.
Which I don't think I've seen a lot.
Yeah, no, that's right.
We're also in 2024 America. She shot a little short on this one, but...
Yeah. If you want to feel much better about the state of the world, read this book. Things are great and awesome. And we don't live in Parable of the Sower. That's great. Congratulations,
comparatively,
everyone.
Yes, we made for it. The timeline.
But yeah, no, it's a very dark, brutal place. There are, would you be surprised to hear that there's great inequality in this book? Like, I mean, I guess we've already been talking about that. You know, that's always been a problem in not even just America, if we're being honest, almost everywhere on Earth. But anyway, it's a problem here. But yeah, there's some parallels to our troubled times, and we'll talk, actually, we should just mention it now. We'll talk about it more with the sequel, but just as a testament to like her sort of like prescience though, and sort of seeing the undercurrents in society. In the sequel, there's a Christian nationalist who's a bad guy running for president. And his campaign slogan is "Make America Great Again," It's wild.
It's unbelievable. Brent was a little ahead of me on reading the sequel, and he's like, tell me when you read like the first, whatever, 20 pages. And I was like, okay, what's going to happen? And then the second I read that line, I was like, that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. So crazy. So crazy. Like she totally saw the undercurrent. Anyway, so I think, you know, fortunately she was wrong about the general descent into anarchy, but she also, I think, was, you know, accurately assessing some parts of American society and how we all sort of clank against each other. Anyway.
And the things that divide us. Yeah.
Yep.
And she actually was an interesting woman. She died in 2006, unfortunately, before she finished.
Yeah, she's only 58.
Yeah. And she planned to write more of these. More on that in the post-spoilers section. But she was the first sci-fi writer to receive a MacArthur Fellowship, or as it's kind of more commonly known, the Genius Grant, the MacArthur Genius Grant. You know, the reason I transitioned into this from what you're talking about America is reading more about her past this book feels very much like she wrote it about herself, maybe, or that, you know, she wanted to include a lot of details about her own life and the observations she'd made. And Earthseed definitely feels like something she'd thought a lot about and written a lot about, and she was like, where do I put this? I'll put it in this story. That's fine. And that's why it feels like it doesn't totally belong, but it's still such a cool concept and all the ideas are so great. So
yeah. And it really animates Lauren's character. She feels Lauren's character, I don't know how much of herself she put into Lauren, but Lauren feels like, you know, she embodies these ideas and she's a little preachy about them. She's a little annoying sometimes, you know, but like she's perfect. She's just like such a character who like, it feels like this character wrote that stuff, you know, it feels very natural. So anyway, yeah. The other thing I would say about sort of just the writing is, I guess we haven't even mentioned yet, like this is sort of a YA book. It got all the classic YA tropes, right? It's like about a teenager written from first person diary style, but it is not at all too pulpy. Like I would never hesitate to recommend this to any adult. And there's some things that happen in it that definitely are like taboo in YA world. We'll maybe talk about one of those in the spoiler section. yeah, I think it really, it was a really nice like dip into that like YA pulp without, you know, feeling like I was reading something I shouldn't be.
Yeah, absolutely. It was also kind of like a little bit of a, as an American, you know, it was like, I think the realism, the how realistic she made the world and she made the future America seem, whether or not the literal year in the book is 2024, definitely felt a little bit like a gut punch. And unlike other post-apocalyptic where it's like, oh, what would a world look like if everyone died or something? It's a little bit too real and a good motivator to actively try not to descend into something like this.
Yeah, for sure. Should we do similar books and then we can do post spoilers after that?
Yeah, absolutely. Did you want to talk a little bit about Parable of the Talents first to the sequel? Or?
Oh, just like review stuff. Okay, so general, very high-level review stuff before we'll talk more on the post-spoilers, but still.
Because it does feel like these two books belong together. Like, I definitely wanted to just finish up after I read Parable of the Sower.
Yeah, it's definitely a continuation of the same story. I didn't like the sequel quite as much. The pacing felt a little off. For reasons that we'll get into a little bit later. And it was slightly more melodramatic. It did feel a little more pulpy to me. But if you love the first one, like definitely keep reading. You get a lot more of the same. So anyway, yeah, that was kind of my take. What'd you think of it?
You know, I thought it was, I didn't quite like it as much either, but I thought what it delved into a lot more, which I was very interested in was really explored the kind of the philosophy of the social organizing force, of like organized religion as a social organizing force, and put Earthseed against the other religions, but mainly in this book, like Christianity in America, and particularly like Christian nationalism. And I thought that it was an excellent exploration into that, into the philosophy of like why people seek religion and why people organize around it. But it wasn't, so it was a little different than the first book in that respect, but I thought it was also good.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, similar books. We've got Emily St. John Mandel, Station 11. We did an episode on that one. You can check that out, but you know, great post-apocalyptic book. Much different vibe, but also excellent and has a lot of interesting ideas.
I'm going to do Where Late the Sweet Bird Sang by Kate Wilhelm, which was a Hugo winner from the 70s with about a dystopian societal collapse with like some very strong Silent Spring, you know, we destroyed the environment overtones. And I really, really like the book. I think it's like personally my... the Hugo winner that I think is like most underrated. I've never heard very few people talk about it. We've been thinking about doing an episode on it because it's like maybe something that needs a little light shown on it. Anyway, if you liked this one, please like leave us a comment on YouTube or shoot us a note on one of the socials. Let us know. We'll sort of like bump it up the list, but it's definitely one we've been thinking about covering because I think it's underrated.
Absolutely. You go.
You're
next.
Yeah. The Road by Cormac McCarthy. It's his dystopian fall with, you know, lots of literary elements. Extremely dark book, but also extremely good. I don't know if we'll ever cover that. It's like kind of far afield from the world of sci-fi, but also it's so good. Anyway, we'll see, but it's great. Y'all should read it.
Right. It is. And then finally, I would suggest The Water Knife by Paolo Bacigalupi because... it is very similar. It's about drought in the American Southwest and what climate disaster does to people there. And it's just kind of a gripping little like journalist mystery thriller. But it has also a fascinating perspective on kind of realistic looks at what climate change could do to places and what kind of fallout there would be. I really loved The Water Knife.
Nice.
So with that said, how about a 3 and please leave if you don't want spoilers, and a 2 and a 1. Brent, okay. What you got? This shouldn't be long, but we just want to say a couple things.
Yeah. All right. So here's what happens. So in that first book there, the big driving factor is a gang of drug-addled pyromaniacs storm their compound, burn down all the houses, kill most of the people. Lauren escapes, and with a couple other survivors, she gets on the road and starts walking north, hoping for more water in Northern California, basically. The journey is pretty tough, and their like sort of band grows as they go. They sort of are picking up like more people who are, you know, maybe like interrace couples, which is kind of frowned upon in this world, or, you know, people with young children who need protection. They sort of like grow the group that way and create safety. And then she meets this like guy in his 50s or 60s named Bankole, who they meet on the road, and she falls in love with this dude. And she's like 17 at this point. So this is the non-YA thing that happens. This relationship.
It's kind of badass though.
Yeah, it's like portrayed as like an incredibly great, healthy relationship. Okay, she's 19 by this point. Okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
I guess age of consent, but still extremely weird. But anyway, in the book, it's like a very positive thing. So they go to his land in Northern California. He owns some land, and that's where the first book ends. Second book, Parable of the Talents, picks up there. They've built like a community. They're calling Acorns the first Earthseed community. They all believe in her religion. They're at like 60 people, and then this Christian nationalist gets into office. A bunch of Christian nationalists storm their compound, kill a bunch of them, including her husband, take all the kids, and put them all in Sterling collars. They escape. Eventually, Lauren can't find her daughter. Oh, one of her brothers shows up. He's alive, and now he's a preacher in this church that committed this crime against her, and he doesn't really do anything to help. That's very tough. And then the book skips 50 years, and her daughter is upset with her and meets her, and they shoot a rocket into space to go to go to Earthseed. That's it.
It's got an interesting framing because it's told by the narrator instead of Lauren is now her daughter, who is reading old diary entries of Lauren's and also talking about her life in the present, the daughter's life. So it cuts back and forth between these two times as we go.
Yeah.
It's not chronological. And that's an interesting framing device.
But you don't
get
any information about what's... So the reason, part of the reason I say the pacing is wrong is that is true. But in the sections in like the present told by her daughter, you don't actually get any information about the present. You just get how the daughter feels about Lauren, which is fine. I'm not saying we shouldn't have that. But it felt extremely weird that like the book covers like 2 years and then... The last four chapters are like, are so far in the future with like nothing in between. It's just like, oh yeah, it worked. Great. Now we have Earthseed where we built spaceships.
Anyway. Right. We do get to the spaceships. I do think there's an element of she wanted to write more books beyond this. And so it kind of dangles, unfortunately. But, you know, the more we talk about it, I think probably you disagree, but I like Parable of the Sower. I think Parable of the Sower is more of a page turner. It's got a cool world. It's got good characters, got good action, whatever. Parable of the Talents, not as much of a page turner, but I really liked the weird, the different philosophies it explored, like I talked about earlier. But then also we have the relationship between her and her brother, who she can't convince to leave the church, even though the church enslaved her for a year and a half, who then finds the daughter. But then doesn't tell Lauren he's found the daughter because he kind of wants to keep the daughter to himself, but also doesn't want to like let go of the church and has been preaching against her Lauren's church, Earthseed, the whole time. So there's a lot of interesting like relationship and social organizing forces and philosophy in the second one. And that's why I like the second one a lot too.
I agree. I like all those parts. The thing that and I still liked it. Don't get me wrong. The thing that just hit me a little bit wrong was it was still told with that same, like the vast majority of the book is like very like on this day we did this thing, on the next day we did this thing. It's like very like methodical and sort of like tightly focused on the small set of events. And so it was like, it just felt strange that was how we spent like almost all our time. But then I agree with you. There was a bunch of really cool things happening, but it was mostly this like bigger stuff that was happening outside this frame of the particular 2 years that we're getting the day by day narration. So that just felt a little weird, but no, I don't disagree at all. I think all that stuff was great.
Yeah. I think overall the series is the two books, I guess you call that a series, were excellent. And I really appreciate when you see something that's just kind of weird and different and the author just, that's what they wanted to write. And it's good because it's good. And you can't sense any rule following or like, well, I probably shouldn't do that because most people don't do that in this scenario. Octavia Butler just threw a bunch of stuff together and made great books out of it.
Yeah, I totally agree. They were really, really fun. And I'm glad we got a chance to read them. And to have a little holidays episode. Break up the break here.
Yes, happy holidays, everybody. Yeah. And we'll see you in the new year. We're excited to get back to it.
For sure. All right. Yeah. We'll see you on January 3rd, everybody.
All right. Later.
Bye.